From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Lucy Walker had always been drawn to cherry blossoms, and she had good reasons. In March of 2011, she had planned to travel to Japan to film the sakura, that brief season in the country when the blooms erupt magnificently and then just as quickly die. She had a modest idea in mind to shoot a 5-minute visual haiku, and then the earthquake struck and the tsunami. The film she did make turned out to be a visual poem about the fleeting nature of life. Walker wanted to find out what had happened to the people who survived and how, as one man put it, they let the blossoms treat their sadness. This morning, we're rebroadcasting our conversation with Lucy Walker. She joined us last night as part of our documentary film series, Through the Lens. Join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There's a moment in Lucy Walker's film Wasteland where the Brazilian artist Vic Muniz talks about the human factor. The film is about Muniz's project to create art with some of the catadores, the people who pick through the garbage in the world's largest landfill outside of Rio. Muniz talks about how a person looking at a painting will lean in. From far away, it's one thing. It's an image or an idea. But up close, the painting vanishes and they see the paint, the material that made the image. That idea of proximity and distance is one that Lucy Walker explores in her documentary films. Her work, she says, is about getting to know people you normally wouldn't and going places you normally don't have access to, like the inner circle of an Amish community or a school for the blind in Tibet or a Brazilian slum. Walker says these are places she is interested in, so she describes the process of making a film as jumping into the deep end. Today in the program, we're live at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center in downtown Salt Lake City as we continue our series of conversations about documentary film. Lucy Walker is with us for the evening. She's directed 4 feature documentaries. Devil's Playground followed teens experimenting with life in mainstream society. Blind Sight was the story of 6 blind Tibetan teens who climbed to the base camp of Mount Everest. Wasteland, which earned her an Academy Award nomination, as we said, captured the creative process of Vic Muniz. Countdown to Zero is about nuclear terrorism and proliferation. Her most recent is The Tsunami and the Cherry Blossom, which won the Short Film Jury Award at this year's Sundance Film Festival. And we should say it also earned her a 2nd Oscar nomination. And Lucy Walker is with us. And Lucy Walker, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much.
So I wanted to start, you were born and raised in London. And when you were young, you lost the sight in one of your eyes, which made me wonder just what effect that had on your affection for, you know, visual images. You always loved movies, I guess, and photography. Did it have a relationship? Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And I also had this funny experience of seeing differently with 2 eyes and then differently again when I had glasses or contact lenses. So I could always see the world with different sort of in focus, out of focus. I do have some vision in my right eye. It's just not, it's not what anyone else would think of as useful vision. I can't, it's not correctable. It's not like short-sighted. It's what they call amblyonic. My brain doesn't listen to it. So it's sort of a garbage image. So I've always had these different images, and I guess that kind of maybe was part of what made me interested in film. And then when I studied film, I realized that other people need to sort of forget about 3D to work with film, which is a 2D image. Yeah. We had a camera class where the cinematography teacher would say, you have to learn to use light to paint in 3D on a flat screen. And I realized that that was what I did all the time. I don't see actually 3D. Mm-hmm. I see 2D and use the light to make it 3D. And there turns out to be, I recently learned, lots of fabulous film directors with one eye, like Nicholas Ray, John Ford, Fritz Lang. I'm in, like, excellent company. this is a funny fact about me. Yeah, absolutely.
At university, you were interested in, for a time anyway, theater.
Yeah.
You acted some. So were you thinking of a career on the stage at some point?
No, you know what? I loved to act when I was a kid. And when I got to about 16, I realized I wasn't any good and I was too shy. But I really liked being around it. It was so fun. So I was always the one saying, oh, hey, I'll be the director. because that way I got to be involved. I never thought anything of it. It was no big deal. But I directed all these shows in high school and then in college until I gained actually kind of a lot of experience. And then I started videotaping the plays. Mm. And at that point, I was like, boy, this is even more fun than the plays, because with a camera, I could get into close-ups. Yeah. And if you've got terrible eyesight, the bummer about theater is you can't see people's faces very well. Hmm. And I loved watching movies, but I'd never been able to think of myself as a filmmaker. I didn't know many creative people or people with exotic professions growing up. My parents had kind of pretty ordinary lives, and I'd never met a film director before. And I don't know, maybe it was because I was a girl as well, but it just didn't seem like something you could pursue as a career. But then that was when the penny dropped, when I was videotaping the plays and thinking, hey, this is a little bit like making movies, and it's really, really, really fun.
You were pretty young when you left England. You were like 22.
Yeah, even younger. Yeah, exactly.
And it's interesting, I read something where you said that, I'm not sure if you still feel this way, but at some point, it wasn't this long ago, you said that you were still wondering if you belong anywhere or where you belong anyway. What were you getting at there?
Well, I do think that we are so used to, in this day and age, dashing around the planet and going off here for a semester abroad or, you know, engaging with different parts of the world. And it's wonderful, but sometimes, you know, you don't quite fit back where you came from. I moved to New York City when I was young and super excited to be there, and became a real New Yorker. I spent all my 20s in New York City, and it was actually very hard for me to move back to the UK. And then I wound up moving to Los Angeles more recently. So I feel like, you know, there's sort of a feeling that you don't, it's a gift that I'm equally at home in the US and the UK, but there's also a sort of price you pay in that you're never quite always sort of complete in one place. There's always other places in your mind and other friends who aren't around. And when we think of the perks of how cosmopolitan we are, sometimes we forget about that cost. And that can be a little confusing. I think for some people, they get a little confused. I really related to the Amish kids, for example. Yeah. The ones that left, you know, it was tough for them because they never quite felt complete in either place, I think.
Do you... Well, there's a moment actually from the film that I wanted to talk about. It sort of leads us into this this question of from Devil's Playground. And there's a young woman by the name of Velda.
Yeah.
Do you want to say something about her? Because I want to play this moment for people with her wedding dress. She makes her own wedding dress, and she kind of expresses this idea of not sure where she belongs. She figured she did, and she goes out, and then she's not sure anymore. Say something about Velda first.
Well, Velda had a particularly dramatic story because she was all set to be getting married, and she was very excited to be getting married and very much in love with her fiancé. But she was starting to think that she wanted to leave the Amish church. And if you leave once you've already been baptized, you get shunned. Your family and friends will not talk to you. You can't sit at the same table. You know, you're really literally shunned by your entire community. And in the Amish religion, there's no divorce allowed. Yeah. So her last chance of persuading her fiancé to leave failed. And the night before her wedding, she decided to leave because it was the last ticket out. And so she had to call off the wedding, leave, be shunned by everybody as she was breaking up with the fiancé that she was in love with. And in the movie, she when I was filming, she put on her wedding dress, which is actually black. Amish wedding dresses, interestingly, are black, very dark. And she'd made this dress herself, and it was the first time she'd put it on since she'd made it. And then she talked to me in the movie. It's a very powerful moment.
When I made the dress, I really liked it. I guess when I made it, I was thinking on the day that I would get married, I would feel like a queen. But now that I have it on, I don't see it that way anymore. I see it as something that covers up the girl that I really want to be. makes me feel like I used to when I was Amish. Like, I had nowhere to go.
What were you thinking when you were filming that?
A really funny story about that scene.
Really?
Do you want to hear it?
Yeah, it's yours.
This was like the worst moment of my life because I'd been working on this film forever. I had been for months in Pennsylvania where it was really, really difficult to film because the Amish community there is actually particularly anti-filming. In the different communities take different rules to different degrees of seriousness in the Amish. And I'd been in Pennsylvania and I'd gone to Indiana where we were here. And actually they were a little bit more lenient about filming and I started to get more people to film. But I'd been working on the film for about 6 months by now and I hadn't filmed an Amish person yet.
Wow.
And I met Velda because I've been hanging out with so many people and working so hard. And Velda was like the... how I got to Velda was I had a boyfriend whose stepmom had grown up Mennonite but had an Amish cousin whose bishop lived next door to her sister's bishop. And every time you went through, you know, a closed community, which the Amish was, is very close when you're inside. So I realized that to kind of get inside, you had to sort of have one person introduce you to the next person. But it was a lot of chains of me saying, you know, this is wonderful to meet you, and I'm trying to make a film, and you probably don't want to be filmed, but maybe you know somebody who would like to be filmed, until I got to Velda. And I was so excited, and she let me film, and then she put the wedding dress on, and we did a version of this scene, but it was even more amazing, and she was crying, and she turned to me as the first tear trickled down her cheek, and she talked about how in love she was, and it was screen magic. And we filmed for about 40 minutes, a full tape's worth. And then she was spent, and she went to sort of sob on her bed and take the dress off. And I was just working myself and a camera person. And I turned to the cameraman when she left the room, and we were just sort of, you know. This was like 6 months of work, and suddenly we knew we had a movie. And then suddenly we realized that the camera had jammed and we wanted to check the tape. We hadn't gotten a frame of it. And I had to go back to the bedroom where she was just composing herself and say, that was great.
Do it again.
Exactly. Exactly. And we did.
Wow.
And that was tough. And this was take two. And it was in my dreams, the take one that we never got.
Yeah.
It's like, I feel like a fisherman with that story of the scene we never got with Velda. This is such a pale imitation of the scene, and it's still an incredibly moving scene.
I want to ask about A Wasteland. It's a film I mentioned earlier. It follows the Brazilian artist, Vic Muniz. He goes to this the world's largest landfill, in fact, the Jardim Gramacho outside of Rio, and he makes art with some of the catadores, the people who pick through the garbage looking for this recyclable material. It's interesting, you, for a while, and long before this, you had your own interest in garbage.
It's true. It's true. I had, when I'd been at film school, met a professor at NYU who had a graduate seminar in garbageology, and I thought she was crackers to start with. We were in this triathlon club together, but I was pricking out my ears and thinking, how do you teach a seminar in garbage, and what is that about? So I started listening in and asking her about the course, and when she screened some films one day, she said, hey, you're a filmmaker, maybe you want to come along. They're really good, and I did. Actually, one's Brazilian film called Las Ilhas das Flores. It's about the life cycle of a tomato and how it winds up in the garbage, and it's really, really good little film. And then she was going on a trip to a landfill and invited me along. And I thought, wow, that's amazing. I've never been to a landfill. It was Freshkills in Staten Island. This was in 2001, right before they closed it. They put the remnants of the World Trade Center in that landfill, and then they closed it up. But at that stage, it was all of New York City's trash. And I was in this place standing on top of this giant garbage pile, and I had this realization, oh my goodness, everything I have ever thrown away since I lived in New York City is in this pile. And it's such a vivid, disgusting place, and you're kind of confronted with your own waste in such a powerful way. And I had never seen a landfill in a movie before. And it was such a strong, strong, strong location that I immediately thought, boy, I've got to make a movie about garbage. This is fascinating stuff. I've got to make a movie at a landfill. There were plastic bags flapping, birds everywhere, and just these giant sort of hills of garbage. And that was a thought that popped into my brain when I met Vic and had been talking to him actually for months about, should we do a movie together? What could we do a movie about? And I'd learned so many things about him that were fascinating, but I still didn't know, how do you make a good movie about an artist? Yeah. Even the best artists, it's tough to think, how do you make that into a movie? I don't go and rent movies about my favorite artists. I rent movies that have good stories, or take me to a world I've never seen before, or my friends tell me are great. I don't rush out and rent something just because it's about Vincent van Gogh or whatever. And Vic's an amazing artist, but he's not the world's most famous. So in trying to figure out, I was thinking, well, maybe we could follow one project, and maybe we could follow a project where he collaborates with non-artists, because he had a real gift for that. Yeah. I'd seen lots of examples of that. And I'd also realized that he was living in New York City at that time and had grown up super poor in Brazil and now was super rich as an art in the art world in New York, but sort of having a midlife crisis. So I sort of had all these different thoughts, but we still didn't know what the project was. And then I had this thought. I said, well, you work with interesting materials. Boy, have you ever thought about working with garbage? Because I used to go to this garbage seminar, and I know it's a really, really actually surprisingly fascinating and important material, right? And he said, totally. I've got this dream project to work in a garbage dump, but it's too dangerous. And I guess as when you hear too dangerous, part of you as a filmmaker thinks too dangerous, and part of you thinks, great, too dangerous. Right. It means really exciting and interesting, and nobody else has been there, and maybe if we can figure out a way to do it safely, we'll be the first people to do it, and yeah. That'll be interesting. And I had also seen a film about catadoras, the people who pick through the garbage for the recyclables, and I said, oh my goodness, do they have catadoras in Brazil, the pickers? And he said, yes. And I instantly thought about how he'd grown up in poverty and their poverty, and I knew in that great moment, I knew also that if he did artwork, he could collaborate with them, and he was great at collaborating, and that he could use the artwork to give back to them who would be so poor, and it would be this incredible beginning, middle, and end, which is what you look for when you're trying to figure out what film to make. And in that light bulb moment, I really saw what Wasteland could be. I didn't yet know how amazing the people would be, but that structure was really clear. And then later on, we kept chatting, and he'd come up with new ideas. I said, no, that's the idea. But if you ever decide to do that project, just call me, and we'll film it from the very, very, very beginning. Mm. And don't even talk to your wife. Don't even look at Google Earth, and we'll film it. Yeah. And that's exactly what happened.
Yeah. You were talking about him going through this kind of crisis, and I wanted to play that early moment where Vic talks about this, where he's not tired of fine art, but he does feel that conflict of his upbringing and the life that he's living now. And you see that throughout the film, that conflict and that tension. Here's Vic Muniz from the film Wasteland.
Right now, I'm at this point in my career that I'm trying to step a little bit away from the realm of fine arts. This, I think, it's a very exclusive, very restrictive place to be. What I really want to do is to be able to change the lives of a group of people with the same material that they deal with every day. And not just any material. The idea I have for my next series is to work with garbage.
There's this moment in the film where Vic he's embarked on the project, and he's come to know these people, and they're extraordinary people. And he's talking to them. He's got them all gathered, and he's talking to them. It's this thing that I mentioned in the introduction about this idea of proximity and distance, and he talks to them about when you look at a piece of art. Now, the challenge for doing this on radio is that he's speaking to them in Portuguese, but I wanted to play a little bit of this anyway. And I wanted you to talk about the moment first, if you would, because he talks about this time, this thing when one thing turns into another thing. And it seems like a really important moment in the film.
I agree. And he's got this wonderful gift. I do wish he was speaking English for the purposes of radio, because he has this wonderful gift of explaining art to non-artists in such a way that everyone gets it. And he's talking about how a piece of art is made up of brushstrokes or collage bits, and you can or photographic ink, you know, and you can get right in there and you can see the dots, or you can step back and see the picture of the beautiful landscape. And he really plays with that. And it really made me think about our journey making the film and the journey the audience takes, because you start out so far away from Brazil and from the landfill, and you've got this idea in your head about these people, what they might be like who live in the landfill. And then the film and follows Vic, the artist, as he goes there. And to start with, they're sort of across the way and he's on the landfill and sort of meeting them for the first time. And then he gets to know them, and then he does a project with them, and then their lives are entwined and you're so close to them that at the beginning, you know, you feel like you're a million miles away, and by the end you feel like you're completely close. And it's a bit like how Vic talks about that artwork, you know. And I wish actually that we'd called the movie The Human Factor. I think that's a really, really good title. And I kicked myself a little bit for calling it Wasteland, because the film is the title is quite bleak, but the film is actually really uplifting and positive and amazing, because the artwork has this incredibly positive impact on the community. Everyone loves it, and all kinds of wonderful, wonderful positive benefits result. So Wasteland seems a little bit bleak, and The Human Factor would actually have been a great title, but I chose not to call it that. Oops.
Well, bear with us, radio audience. You're going to hear some very lovely Portuguese here from Vic Muniz.
Aí ele vê o óleo, o homem pescando, vê que tá ali, depois ele faz assim, e aquilo lá tudo se perde e vira tinta. Ele vê o material, né? Aí ele se afasta, vê a imagem. Ele se aproxima, vê o material. Ele se afasta, ele vê a ideia. Ele se aproxima, ele só vê a matéria.
It's a great moment.
Yeah, it's a great moment.
And I think they get it, you know.
Totally. Which is, we didn't know when we made the film, you know, what is it like? What has life brought somebody if their best option is picking through the garbage?
Yeah.
And so we didn't know what kind of people we were going to be dealing with, but it turned out they were incredibly cool, people with a lot of grace and dignity, and that the work was really a sort of active environmental heroism. They're taking the recyclables out of the landfill when nobody else, there's no separation, there used to be no separation of recyclables in Brazil, but they've never seen art before. So what were they going to make of him talking about art museums, because they've never been to one before?
Yeah.
But he's such a good explainer that they get it.
The most kind of wrenching theme, I think, in the film is this, it comes from this argument that Vic has with his wife. And she's wondering, and it's a real concern, and I still feel conflicted about it in some way. And she's saying to him, all right, so you're taking these catadores who had nothing, you're bringing them into this project, you're involving them in this amazing project, and then what happens when you're done? Now they've experienced this thing, they've had this amazing moment, and then what, you send them back into the landfill? It's a really terrific question. Let me play this moment from the film. This is Victor and his wife at the time. And she raises this question because I want to know what you think about all of this from the film, Wasteland.
Should you take them to London? I think it's quite it's a super delicate question, because like that, if you're starting to change them already, just bringing them to the other studio, just involving them in a different lifestyle in Rio, what's going to happen to them once you take... to, you know, put them in a plane.
You were saying, well, this is going to mess up with their minds. Well, maybe their minds need to be messed up with.
But if you shake them up and say, hello, this is all, you know, life is different, you could do this, you could do that, is it realistic enough to think that they, what can they do with that afterwards here?
It's really hard for me to imagine doing something that would do much damage to them. Do worse than what has been done to them already. Why does it have to change somebody's life forever?
As long as you think that the person can cope with it afterwards. But if you don't, if you're not sure if the person can deal with it, people are fragile.
Oh, it is my responsibility.
Your responsibility, I think, is more to deixa eu falar.
No, you say it's not my responsibility.
He doesn't let me talk.
I'm saying it is.
Yeah, she's saying you don't let me talk.
She's mad, and she's got a good point. So what did you do with that question? Because surely you thought about it from time to time.
Well, as a filmmaker, I was just glad they had that discussion out loud, because then you can film it and put it right in the movie.
Yeah.
And so the question that you're sort of struggling with is right there in the movie for everyone to sort of debate. And I sometimes think that that's what's wonderful about documentaries. Sometimes reality will sort of out and bite you. There's no hiding from it. I did a blind sight when we climbed Everest with these incredible young blind Tibetans. But the expedition was unraveling. And there started to be this huge question about, is it too dangerous? We had blind American mountaineer Eric Weinmeier, amazing guy, saying, we need to get to the top. And blind German teacher Sibria Tenberken saying, this is crazy. This is dangerous. We don't want anyone to die. And they're both right. And that was the tension on the expedition. And you know what? We couldn't keep it out of the film because it actually exploded. And everyone started arguing about it. And as a filmmaker, you think, well, that's the truth of what this moment is. This moment isn't just a simple mountain climb. This film is a giant question. Should people make statements with blind people climbing Mount Everest or not? And that's a really, really interesting question. And the discussion with Vic and Janina is so interesting. To be totally self-absorbed for a second, it reminds me a little bit of my, you know, point about when I moved from the UK to the US, and you don't quite fit back. I feel the pain in a way of the Catadoras. Once you leave the landfill and go to the fabulous art studio and get used to being an art star, you know, is it easy to go back to the landfill? You know, life's a bit more complicated than it used to be. But I must say that if you step back and think, what are the benefits and the costs of the film, when you sort of observe, I've been blown away by how many positive impacts there have been. And I've been looking closely for the negative impacts, and I haven't seen any yet. But the good news about what happened to everybody involved in the film as a result and how their lives have unanimously sort of improved has been incredible. The latest news is that Tiao, who's the one of the garbage pickers, who's the head of the association. He formed an association to make life better for his fellow pickers. And he has now been picked to be one of five Brazilians carrying the Olympic torch in London this year, which is a huge honor. And for a picker who was a very ostracized group of people, to be picked with this tremendous honor really shows you how far I think Wasteland has changed people's minds in Brazil about how important these people are.
Lucy Walker is with us. We're live at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center in downtown Salt Lake City as we continue our series and documentary film Through the Lens, but we need to take a break. So we'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are continuing a series on documentary film. We're live at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center with the filmmaker Lucy Walker. I wanted to ask you about, you were mentioning blind sight and that moment you were talking about with Sabrie Tenberken, I think. Is that how she pronounces it? She's an amazing find. I mean, really, really extraordinary. And I wanted to actually play a moment from the film, that moment that you were talking about, or at least one of them, where the question is, and it's great, it's this tension throughout the film, where you've got these guys from the West, the Intermountain West too, Colorado, right? And they're used to, you got to get the summit, even though Eric had summited Mount Everest. You may have heard the story. It's pretty extraordinary. And he wants these kids to summit. Sabrie doesn't really care about that. She thinks it's about something bigger or something else, and that tension plays out throughout. I wanted people to hear Sabri's voice because this is one of the moments where she's really expressing that in a beautiful way. This is from the film Blind Sight.
For me, blindness has a lot to do with imagining things. It's a constant imagination, actually. You imagine everything, what you smell and feel or hear.
Move on, keep going up.
So sometimes we want to really stop and enjoy with all our senses. And the kids told me that it is not so much fun to just climb or to just walk, because they had never really time to tell a story or to think of a story or to just smell or to listen. For example, icicles falling down. And also the whole herd of yaks with the different bells. It's beautiful. And so I had the feeling, is it really the right thing? This goal to get every child to the summit. Is it really something we would do for the kids? Or is it just something we would do to show something?
Do you ever think about that in terms of your film? Like, what is the point of what I'm doing? Like, what do you know what I mean? What is my goal? Am I doing it for the, you know, are my motives pure or are they right? Does that make sense?
Oh, I question myself all the time. Yeah, I think that's important. And, you're dealing with other people's lives when you're making documentaries. So it's a huge privilege, and you've got to really keep that in check. And I believe that film is the most vivid, powerful way you can experience life from somebody else's point of view. Film gives you an opportunity to walk in somebody else's shoes. And with documentaries and the tools we have now to make wonderful films out of real life, so messy real life, you can use a cheap camera and shoot a bunch of stuff and then shoot and then edit on a non-linear system, which gives you the control and flexibility to craft a really well-wrought story. And we have these tools now that we can make movies, incredibly moving, powerful, well-crafted film, cinema experiences out of people's lives. And what an amazing opportunity that is. I really believe that we expand as human beings our circle of compassion. There's a fabulous book that came out last year by Steven Pinker called about how violence is actually being reduced. A lot of people think maybe the world is getting more dangerous and scary, but he has a wonderful message, which is actually the world's getting to be much safer. And a big part of this is media, where we're much more connected to people far away from us than we ever used to be. Mm. It's hard to imagine painting enemies in the same way as even 100 years ago, because now we've had stories where we've experienced their point of view. So I think it's really exciting opportunity to do that, but also a great privilege. So you're constantly making sure you're not endangering them. On Blind Sight in particular, I was just super worried that people were going to fall and be endangered, because also people are affected by the presence of cameras, and I didn't want people to be showing off for the camera and die or kill someone. And this was super worrying, actually.
You said at once that there's no such thing as objectivity, or you don't believe in objectivity.
I think that's right. When you put a camera in the mix, a funny thing happened actually with the blind. Those blind kids are sharp, and you can see it. They're absolutely fantastic and brilliant, these kids. But there's one moment where they say to one of the Americans who's guiding them, "How come you tense up your arms every time you're talking to Lucy?" They're blind, and they rustled like they're like, you know, flexing their biceps because I'm filming them. When I'm talking to them, that means the camera is rolling and we're filming them. So there they are hiking along with their biceps flexed because they look really, you know, handsome that way. And the blind kids were caught onto it, you know. And it's true. I mean, we're all, I mean, you know, if someone started filming me, I'd certainly be concerned to put my best foot forward. I'd be a terrible person to film. You know, the people that are amazing in my documentaries are the people that actually have the courage to let it all hang out, the courage to, for example, say, yeah, I'm Amish and I want to be a bishop like my dad. It's just I have this crystal meth problem. Do you want to see me? I'm just about to, you know, that's the kid. You're like, you want to film that kid. You don't want to film the kid who's like, well, yeah, sure, I smoke, but I'm hiding it behind my back till you turn the camera off, you know. You want people that are going to be really, really open and courageous in sharing their experience, because that's what we in the audience can really, really relate to. And that's when I think, you know, that's what you want to be getting, is people relaxed and forgetting the camera is there. But at the same time, you can never really forget it's there, because it isn't. And your presence does change everything.
You know, I think about this question all the time. Does a story, particularly in these films, does a story come from a question? Or does it come from a moment or experience? Do you know what I mean? Is there something you can say, a question you can ask that elicits a story? Or do you just have to wait for it to emerge?
I like those questions, because when you're making a documentary, you don't necessarily know the answers.
Yeah.
Goodness knows, in Wasteland, for example, there was a really good chance that those people in the landfill were going to throw that art in Vic's face and say, Art, are you kidding? Have you got any money? And mug him. We didn't know what was going to happen, you know? So the question we knew, and I thought was interesting, the question is, what does art mean to people who are living in a landfill picking through garbage for recyclables? And that question really was interesting to me. What's going to happen? What are they going to make of art? Are they going to want to collaborate? What's it going to be like to see a giant portrait of themselves made out of garbage? You know, what effect is that going to have? I knew it was a really interesting question. And a lot of times with my films, I think that's all I have going in, is that question. What is it like to be an Amish young person encountering our outside world for the first time without all the rules you've grown up with? What is it like to grow up blind in Tibet? Oh my goodness, being super ostracized and having to navigate that. What is it about nuclear weapons in the world today that we really need to know? So these questions are really important, and that's sort of what I cling to in those dark nights when I don't know what the film's going to turn out being and whether or not we're getting enough footage and all that stuff.
Is there always, a moment where you realize, okay, it's a film. I think I can make this work.
I've been lucky that all my films have worked out well, and I've been pretty confident going in that the question was so good that it didn't matter what I got. No. If I didn't get an Amish person, and there were months, as I was saying earlier about Velder, there were months when I couldn't even film an Amish person, and I was thinking that film was going to be beautiful shots of farmhouses with a voiceover of Amish bishop, you know, describing life. I didn't know if I'd actually get a real-life Amish person, but I knew that that story was so important that as a filmmaker, if I was halfway decent, I'd find some way of telling the story. The story was strong enough, and that's what I always come back to. So I've always trusted, and I don't recommend embarking on a documentary unless you know the story is strong enough, that it doesn't matter what happens. Something will happen, and it's going to be interesting because the dramatic situation is inherently interesting.
There is another moment from Wasteland, actually. Walter. We don't see him a lot, but he seemed like kind of the heart of the film in some way.
Oh, he's the bard of the landfill.
Yeah.
He's this incredible character who's been working there for years and says everything in quotes and in rhymes. And cheers everybody up and eggs everyone, because everyone gets down. And then there's the garbage. And he's got a lovely comment, but in rhyme for everybody. And actually, the first day I went to the landfill, because I was there quite a bunch even before Vic got there, and we were location scouting, and I was trying to figure out what equipment I might need to shoot there. And the first person I met from the landfill was Walter. He cycled towards me, and his bicycle was covered in little trinkets from the garbage, and he didn't look like a crazy drug addicted mental health case. You know, I was worried. I didn't know who was going to be in the landfill. Instead, he was the most charming, quirky, delightful person. He flashed a smile and a peace sign at me, and I thought, oh my goodness, this film, this film is going to be amazing because this guy, you just love him. And he turns out to give us a lecture on recycling that will change. I promise it will make even the most lazy person a devoted recycler forever, right? The way he explains it, and he has his catchphrase, 99 is not 100. Every single can that you recycle makes a difference because it's a can that's not in the landfill, polluting the rivers and clogging up the earth forever. And he's so motivating and wonderful.
Lucy Walker is with us. Her most recent film is The Tsunami and the Cherry Blossom. It was nominated for the Academy Award for Best Documentary Short Subject. We're continuing our series on documentary film Through the Lens. We're live at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center in downtown Salt Lake City, and we're going to take another break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center. We're continuing our series on documentary film called Through the Lens. The filmmaker Lucy Walker is our guest. So I want to ask you about The Tsunami and the Cherry Blossom. The story about how this film came to be is kind of miraculous. You know, you were planning on going. You had this idea that you were going to shoot this, kind of small, short haiku, I think is how you were thinking about it, right? Because you have this deep affection for cherry blossoms. And I wanted you to talk about that, if you would. Because in some ways, this is connected to your mother.
It's true. I have lots of memories of cherry blossoms, and I've always loved them and realized only later that Japanese people were exactly the same way. But one of my sad or poignant memories of cherry blossom is that I was taking care of my mom when she had cancer. And there was the day when we were told that it was not treatable. And she looked out of the window, and it was a beautiful spring day in England, and the cherry blossom were outside the window. And she told me a story that when she had been taking care of her mom, who had cancer, my mom had been taking care of her, and my grandmother had turned to her and said, "I'm not going to see the cherry blossoms again." And my mom at that point had only been 20 years old, mm-hmm. and she did not know what to say. She couldn't handle it. So she said, "You'll get well soon." And she left the room. And this has always haunted her. So she wanted to have an honest conversation about life and death. And in that moment, somehow the cherry blossoms were so symbolic of that. For Japanese people, they represent life being fleeting and fragile and precious, but beautiful. And that had always really resonated with me. And then, unfortunately, my father died very shortly after my mom. So I was really grieving. And I happened to be in Washington, D.C. during the Cherry Blossom Festival, beautiful Cherry Blossom Festival. And I noticed that having been really sort of suffering with grief quite, deeply, I was snapped into this present moment and reminded that sort of my life too was passing and I had to sort of get with it and how beautiful it was. And in that moment, it really reminded me to sort of get back to being as happy as possible and get on with life. And it was sort of strangely powerful. These little flowers have this incredible impact. And I also think they're beautiful. I had taken photographs of them when I was learning to take photographs when I was a teenager and realized they made excellent photographic subjects and thought, well, I can make a very short film about cherry blossom, be quite poetic. And I was excited about doing that and was all set to do that. I made that plan last March 3rd. And then last March 11th, of course, the giant triple whammy hit Japan with the earthquake, the tsunami, and then the Fukushima nuclear disaster all hit. And my first thought was, oh my goodness, I don't want to be going to Japan now. Everyone's evacuating. This is too scary. Even tap water in Tokyo was contaminated and nobody knew what was going to happen. But then I had this other thought that nagged at me that was, wait a second. I was all poised to make a film. I have my incredible cinematographer friend, Aaron Phillips, all set to go. And if there was ever a year where the cherry blossom season in Japan was going to be important and poignant. It's going to be this year. I don't think that cherry blossom parties are going to be as fun this year. I think it's going to be a very somber mood. Mm-hmm. But cherry blossom is all about what just happened with this disaster. They're all about life being short and ending. And in a very beautiful way, now is the time to show our appreciation for Japanese culture and solidarity with our Japanese friends, not to run away. Of course, I got terrible cold feet, and having decided to go ahead, I then called out Aaron, the cinematographer, and said, oh, wait, it's not too late to cancel. And he said, you just always get cold feet. Don't worry about it. This is worth doing. And so we did fly into Tokyo at the time when everyone else was flying out. There were no lines at customs going into Tokyo Airport then. We were the only people. And the immigration officer looked like we were totally crazy. But I'm so glad that we did it.
Mm. Seems like... I remember seeing photos of the debris in New York City after 9/11. And I had a similar kind of feeling about the images of the debris that you shot.
Yeah, absolutely. Really, I was in New York actually at 9/11 and the same way. And I had the same feeling. That was how I related to it. That was the other disaster zone that I had been near. And it was Japan's, they actually even call it 3/11 because it happened on March 11th. And for Japanese people, they think a lot in terms of 9/11 and 3/11.
There's a this concept that you've said, which is really important to the way you think about art, wabi-sabi.
Mm-hmm.
This idea that, if I get it right, it's beauty is, it's beautiful, but it's not perfect.
Mm.
Talk about that, why that's important to you. This is a concept in Japanese culture that...
Yeah, it's tough to translate wabi-sabi, but it's such a lovely idea. It's that there can be a beautiful aesthetic that's a little bit more real and a little bit more rustic. You know, something can be, a building can be lopsided and still beautiful. A pot could be, the surface of a pot might be have a texture to it, and that's actually more beautiful than, you know, sort of some kind of mechanized perfect pot. And I feel my films are a little bit wabi-sabi. There's a sort of handmade quality to them, and I think that's hopefully authentic and from the heart and part of their beauty and charm.
The idea also, going back to the cherry blossoms, that, as is expressed, it's like the character of the Japanese, whereas, you know, the blossoms are so tiny, but you don't see them just individually. You see them as this bouquet.
Mm.
You know,
something that was really impressive to me being in Japan after this disaster was how the Japanese sense of community helped them in a crisis. There was so much organization and behavior that was so beneficial in a crisis that I think Japanese people often are used to, because there's a lot of people on a small island. They got very good at living in close proximity to other people in very respectful ways and really taking care of each other. And there are incredible stories. For example, people after the tsunami were trapped in an unheated up, you know, maybe they managed to escape to the top story of a school, but the three underneath stories would have been washed out, and nobody, rescuers didn't get to them for days, in some cases a week. There was no food, no water, and no heat, and a lot of people sheltering there. And when the food finally came, the first rice balls arrived. Do you know what happened? They decided who needed them the most and shared them with the, you know, amongst the people who needed them the most. And it was sort of the opposite of a looting phenomenon. And I was really, really impressed with so many heroic, courageous acts amongst the survivors. And it was really very heartwarming. And I think the cherry blossoms are the same way, that the Japanese people seem that when they club together, they're really very beautiful. And that's something that they relate to with this little flower that's sort of humble by itself, but very stunning when it's all blossoming at once.
The film you're working on now, say something about it if you would. Introduce it. I Ride for Kevin.
Mm-hmm. That's the working title. I'm not sure if it'll stay that title when it premieres. The dream would be to premiere it right here, actually, at Sundance next January. That's my dream. And the film is about an amazing snowboarder named Kevin Pierce, who was until a couple of years ago, one of the best two snowboarders on the planet. And he and Sean White were going head-to-head to prepare for the Winter Olympics 2 years ago when Kevin had a terrible accident in the half pipe here in Park City, landed on his head and had a traumatic brain injury. Fortunately, he was wearing a helmet, which saved his life. But he was in a coma for a long time and they didn't know if he was going to make it. But he fought back, learned to walk and talk and eat again, and now is at the point where he's fully, seemingly fully recovered. He actually still struggles with memory, and the brain injury is very, very severe. And now he's confronting the fact that if he hits his head again hard, he'll die. There's a thing called second impact syndrome, which means that if you have that bad of a brain injury, your brain can't withstand any more knocks. And so he's much more vulnerable moving forward, which is tragic for him because he just wants to snowboard. But he's very lucky to be here with us. So it's been following his entire journey and also celebrating other snowboarders like Sean White, who I was just with last week, who's incredible and just an incredible athlete. But then tragically, there are other stories too. Like there was a particularly tragic story here again in Utah of Sarah Burke, a free skier, same half pipe last January. And she didn't make it. She had a similar accident to Kevin, went to the same hospital, but her story did not go the way that Kevin's did. And so it was sort of understanding the risk that these incredible athletes take with these incredibly beautiful sports.
Lucy Walker, she's the director of Wasteland, most recently The Tsunami and the Cherry Blossom, working on I Ride for Kevin. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to the staff, the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center, Jeff Gwillem, Stephanie Slade, Brad Henry, Marie Jensen, Charles Cooper, and Doug Parkin. Thanks also to Josh Levy, Patrick Hubley, and Geraldine Dreyfus at the Utah Film Center. And our thanks to Eric Nielsen of KUED. Our broadcast was directed by KUER's engineer Lewis Downey with the help from Mike Anderson. Radio West is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.